This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello and welcome to Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. It's the podcast where I sit down with an extraordinary person and they share their story. They might have overcome adversity, they may still be very much on their own journeys, but they all have stories, stories that will make you laugh, cry, and hopefully feel a little bit inspired. My guest on this episode is a former doctor, now a comedian and writer. Some may say it's not an obvious career progression, but that's just the start of what makes this person extraordinary. Adam Kay worked as a doctor for 6 years before leaving the profession in 2010. He kept a journal of his experiences working for the NHS, which later became the 2 million copy bestseller This Is Going to Hurt. His tales included saving his first life, the long nights spent in A&E, and removing many foreign objects from all sorts of body parts. It became the best-selling non-fiction title of the decade, spending over a year at number one in the Sunday Times bestseller chart. And now he's educating kids with his first children's book, Kay's Anatomy. And Adam Kay joins me here now.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I'm very excited. I'm a big fan of yours. And I first discovered you on Twitter because we have a mutual friend, Tim.
We do, yeah.
Yeah, so and that's how I discovered you there. And then
in the nice old days of Twitter, when there was only about 30 people on there and none of them were Nazis.
Exactly. It was a really fun, friendly, it was a great place to get company, you know.
It was it really was.
And I followed you on Twitter. And for me, you know, I'm a patient of the NHS for about 13 years. So, and I have lots of doctors in my life who I do see as human. And when you released that book, I thought, wow, this is amazing. I want to read this insight. I've always wondered, how do doctors do it? And I suppose reading it, I realized they sometimes can't. And we mistakenly do not see them as human. And
we don't want to see them as human. I don't
we're
think.
Told not to. Yeah, absolutely.
You've had more experience with the NHS than probably almost anyone listening. And when, you know, you're meeting your surgeon and they're telling you what they're going to do, you don't want to think of them as being too human because humans make mistakes. You want to somehow elevate them in your mind to someone who's totally infallible. That's part of the defense mechanism we all have. But the flip side of that is that the doctors themselves stop thinking of themselves as human and maybe don't look after themselves as much as they should do. I'll never forget, I used to do this clinic once a week for a year, and it would always overrun. Because the traditional mismatch between number of doctors and number of patients. And it would overrun like significantly, like 2-3 hours. And obviously, you know, at 8 o'clock, when it was meant to be gone at 5 o'clock, I was just apologising to these people who were rightly getting cross about their, you know, the car park and the babysitter and all of that. It was no good. But not once in a year of this did any patient ever say, "Oh, you probably don't want to be here either." Because
they don't,
I didn't.
Right?
Yeah, I didn't. No one does.
It's a very real thing, isn't it? No. Breaks, no, just not being
it
treated
is.
Like a...
You want to do, you know, everyone, the 1.5 million people who work in the NHS desperately want to do their best for the patients, for everyone. That's why they sign up in the first place. But, you know, annoyingly, the system doesn't always allow that to happen. And that's the sort of thing that I wanted to get across in that book. And I'm really glad that that's something that you zoned in on when you read it. It's the book's a bit of a confidence trick because it sells itself as funny, silly stories. And it is, I guess, there is that in there. But ultimately, it hopefully makes people think about something more serious, which is, you know, what it's actually like to be there working on the front line.
Well, I did wonder that because when I read it, you know, if you had any kind of medical treatment, and some people might be quite naive to what really goes on. And if you'd sold it as something else, would people have wanted to buy it? Because some of us want to live life ignorant and naive to these things. Do you think it would have been as big a success?
I mean, if I'd have called it a harrowing polemic about the state of the NHS, I think it would have sold 15 copies and we wouldn't be chatting on your podcast today.
Possibly.
But yeah, I wanted, you know, the skill such as it is that I have is telling funny stories. And I wanted to lean into that and use that as the vehicle to trick people who otherwise might not have read a book about what it's actually like, you know, as a human being, you know, working in the NHS, and get that audience of people and get people thinking about something they wouldn't have otherwise thought about before.
Mm. And people that are still in the NHS couldn't write a book like this? And it's only you that could do this?
I mean, I've not invented the genre of the medical memoir by a century, but I've, you know, and but the fact that I have left the profession allowed me to, well, it meant I had the time to do it. You probably don't have time to rush out a book if you're working 100-hour weeks. Because the truth of it is, a normal day at work for a healthcare professional, there is the funny stuff and there is the desperately sad stuff. And they're often right, you know, next to each other. Like, you know, I worked on labour wards. I was an obstetrician. So, you know, I'd be in an antenatal clinic or something one day. And then someone would say something or do something. And I think I must write this one down. I'm going to be telling this anecdote for the next, you know, decade. And then the next patient you see, you can't find the baby's heartbeat, and it's the most, you know, agonizing, awful moment of this family's life. And it's the nature of the job.
And that's the authenticity of the book. It genuinely, the journals were written with no agenda other than maybe being quite cathartic and helping you offload in private, I suppose.
I mean, that's exactly right. It's the Anytime I say this, it feels so weird because it's so unnatural, but they don't teach you how to cope at medical school. There's they'll teach you how to, you know, resuscitate someone, or they'll teach you even how to break bad news. But there's never any discussion that has an impact back on you. Mm-hmm. And so you have to find your own way of coping. Mm. And, you know, and that's why there's a lot of, you know, alcohol addiction amongst doctors. There's and recreational drugs as well, and it's why a lot of people leave the profession because they can't cope. And
I wondered that if everyone has their shelf life and then they just have to go.
I mean, everyone has a limit. There's a lot of very, very, very robust, you know, people working there who manage to just have thicker armour.
What does that really mean? Because when we say robust, you know, because the British culture, you're not supposed to show emotion, you're not supposed to be upset.
And it's very, very, very unhelpful. Very unhelpful.
Mm. I thought about you a lot in lockdown. Like I said at the start, you know, I'm a big fan. I've read every single book. I came to your theatre show. Me and my mum WhatsApp about you and talk about you. I took her to the... I'm coming across as a bit creepy, I took my mum to the theatre show as well. And, you know, she's having a lot of treatment as well in the NHS. So we kind of bond over you and discuss you. And when we were all clapping, we were like, I wonder what Adam Kay thinks about all the clapping. And, you know, I thought, great. Everyone's appreciating the people on the ground and actually that it's a multidisciplinary approach. It's not just these godlike consultants. It's a whole team. You know, and I already had that appreciation, but it was great to see the whole street and everywhere we turned to have that. But I wonder what it was like for you, because you're sort of, you know, on the outside looking in, but actually knowing what the NHS would have been going through, and still are going through. How did that feel?
So, obviously a lot of my friends and indeed my family, you know, still work on the NHS, and it's been very painful to, you know, to see these people who've always gone so far above and beyond, having to go even further to literally prevent the NHS from collapsing. And, mm-hmm. you know, and people have moved out of their family homes for weeks and months on end so they don't bring back home a potentially fatal virus to a vulnerable member of their family. They've, you know, they've worked double, triple shifts. They've constructed intensive care units out of dust, out of disused corners of the hospital and old operating theatres. If they were lucky enough to have protective equipment, you know, they would come home with pressure sores on their faces from the masks they had to wear. 620 people, according to the medical examiner's office, lost their lives in the first waves of the virus. It's unimaginable for the people who've been working. And I thought it was great that there was this outpouring of love for the NHS. Mm. Obviously, that isn't the same as them being adequately paid, them having the adequate resources to do what they need to do. But it made me think that it reminded us what a good thing we've got, what a uniquely precious thing we have in the NHS. And it made me hope, because through such an awful time, you have to look for the positives. And it really made me hope that if the NHS ever comes under some existential threat in the future, and the spectre of private healthcare or an insurance system or a two-tier system is rearing its head, then I think people would get to their feet and they would shout louder than ever and fight harder than ever to keep the NHS going.
And also, you know, going back to that point about the gratitude, practicing the gratitude for what we've got. And, you know, part of the lockdown was we don't want to overwhelm services, and we don't want to go to A&E if we don't have to, which you would hope most people live by that rule anyway. But then you get the opposite end. I was quite ill and ignoring symptoms because I thought it was something I could just treat myself. And then it turned to sepsis and I collapsed.
Oh my goodness.
It was just a urine infection, and I ignored, and obviously, which was completely stupid, and then ended up in hospital. But I wondered, in the book, and this is going to hurt, you know, you talk about some of the funnier sides of people presenting at A&E with things they tripped and fell on that ended up inserted mm-hmm. in their body. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered similarly, what about when you would be out and about in your personal life, down the pub or at the gym, when people knew you worked in gynae, did you get any sort of people doorstepping you and asking you for advice or diagnosis on the treadmill or anything like that?
Well, I mean, I'm now 10 years out the game, and so I'm pretty sure that people would only contact me if they're more likely to ask, you know, their milkman for medical advice before they're going to ask me now. But certainly over the years, less so now, but more when I was like in my early 30s, everyone was getting pregnant around. In my friendship group, so there was lots of I was a bit of a an on-call antenatal clinic, which is where, but I've had the odd thing where people will show me their rash and whatever, but
lovely.
Yeah, exactly.
See, I have it now where people meet me to make common ground. They tell me about any kind of mild sort of burn they've had on their thumb when opening the oven.
When they touch the toaster, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
And I'm just, right, great. Yeah. Okay. We've got so much in common, you and I.
Oh, my goodness.
But I'm glad people don't suddenly flash you or anything like that, then. That's good to know. But yeah, the odd rash. So now this new book, I've actually got the book in front of me, and love the illustration. Adam Kay's Anatomy, and this is for age 8 to 12 years old, isn't it?
It's for age 8 to 12, but mostly I think it's for their parents who never quite understood the body in the first place. That's if they ever learnt it in GCSE biology.
I printed off the best review. I thought if it gets a bit serious, I can read this. I've got to read it. I'm sure you know this one. Much of it is about bums, poos, bogies, etc., which my 8-year-old thinks is the funniest thing in the world. But there's a section at the back about human reproduction with diagrams of a penis, testes and a vagina, complete with labels for the labia, clitoris, etc. Useful for me, but not appropriate for my daughter. What's your response?
I think that's extraordinary. So the book was written with close collaboration with educational experts and indeed sex ed experts to make sure that, as well as the poo and the wee and the bogies, it was totally delivering everything they need to know for their syllabus. And this gentleman can restrict his daughter's reading as much as he likes, but she's going to be learning it at school, and it's very, very unhelpful and unhealthy to stop people knowing about their bodies. That's how taboos form. Mm-hmm. That's how, you know, people have ending up in all sorts of trouble in the future. But if it taught him where the clitoris is, then I guess that's something, isn't it?
You're just always helping people with these books, aren't you? I wondered if this was the age that you became interested in medicine yourself. Was it always from a young age?
So yeah, I grew up in a medical family. And so it was always going to be like the default setting for how my life was going to go. But I've always been fascinated by the body. And I guess part of the reason for this book was the body's never been quite as cool for kids as like dinosaurs or space and stuff like that. And I just wanted to share my enthusiasm and share some of the, you know, the ridiculous, incredible, you know, things that the body, it's the most advanced bit of kit, you know, ever invented anywhere. It's like the brain is made up of 100 trillion different connections, which is the number of stars in 1,000 galaxies. If you had £100 trillion, you could buy every house on the planet. And it's like these, it's just extraordinary, every aspect of the body. And I guess, again, this book's a bit of a confidence trick, much like my first one was, you know, draw them in and keep them reading, you know, the disgusting facts that, you know, about the year of their life they spend on the toilet, and you know, and the fact that you know astronauts breathe in recycled wee, and the fact that you're covered by a cloud of dead skin and fart particles. You know, keep them reading with that, but at the same time, tell them the stuff that they need to know, and not just the dry stuff that they need for their exams, but also the stuff that is important that they know about. So whilst we're talking about the brain and all the amazing stuff it does, we can also talk about anxiety and depression and panic, and we can talk about autism, we can talk about epilepsy and all these different things that these kids who are reading it or their friends may have, and talking about body image and talking about smoking and alcohol and lots of stuff that I suspect parents don't particularly want to have the conversation about. And even if they do, it maybe just helps them to have the facts. You know, I spent ages putting it together and making sure I said it all in the right way and consulting with experts in every, you know, area. So they can subcontract some of the less fun bits of parenting to this book, and ideally the kids just go away and, you know, up to their bedrooms and read the book for their horrible poo facts, and and along the way just sort of, you know, get a bit of a lesson in some of this quite important stuff.
Also from Something Else.
How did we get here? With Claudia Winkleman and Professor Tanya Byron. In these in-depth one-on-one therapy sessions, we dig deep into personal stories with fascinating and emotional revelations. A passionate, insightful, and moving experience with clear outcomes to each episode.
He is as anxious about attachment with you as you are with him.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. That's crazy, isn't it? Oh, that's a weird feeling. Wait, so... Oh, God. Don't you just feel like, whoa, why didn't I know that all along?
Listen now in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all good podcast apps.
Do you ever wonder how celebrities order food? Like, is Sarah Paulson a Diet Coke or a regular Coke girlie?
Some peasant Coke? No.
Or how does Sofia Vergara order a pizza?
No, no tomatoes. I cannot eat tomatoes.
Are you killed mushrooms?
Not really.
If these are the details you need, and I know you do, I have the podcast for you. I'm Jesse Tyler Ferguson, and on my podcast, Dinner's on Me, I take some notable friends of mine out to dinners in Los Angeles and New York City. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
That thing was delicious.
I realized because I'm so excited about just being one-to-one with you, I've been talking about the book as if every single person will have read This Is Going to Hurt. And actually, we know 2 million of them have read it. But for the people that haven't, you know, when I finished the book in I did one evening, then slept for a bit, then woke up and finished it in the morning because I just couldn't put it down. Then I sent copies to lots of different people and, you know... It is cliche about, you know, you laugh in it, then you start crying. But it did change my life. When I shut the book, I felt anger for you, the way you'd been treated. I felt elated and happy what you were doing now. And for people that haven't read the book, are you comfortable in saying why you left the NHS?
Yeah, absolutely. In the most basic terms, I had a bad day at work. And, you know, we all have bad days at work. That's part of life. But when you're on a labour ward, when all you want from every case is a healthy mum plus a healthy baby, a bad day at work can be when you get neither of those two things. And I was the most senior doctor on the ward. And I basically realised that I couldn't face that kind of thing ever happening to me ever again. And however good you are, however hard you train, all the extra qualifications you get, there will always be these cases where a tragedy happens and you can't do anything to prevent it. And it happens twice a decade if you're the most senior obstetrician on a labour ward. And like I say, I just realised that I couldn't face that again. And I assumed what I would do was take 6 months off, 12 months off, and then I'd retrain in another corner of medicine. But my plan B of writing took off in a way that I didn't think that it would do. At the time, I was writing for television, I thought all I needed was just a break, and then I got into this new career, and I didn't end up going back. And since then, I've been very aware that there isn't enough support for people who are struggling, and in fact, the most, you know, you've listed some achievements that this book's had, which is and it's wild to hear them. All those numbers, it's sort of extraordinary. But the biggest thing that's happened as a result of this book was I've been invited by two secretaries of state for health to speak to them about the NHS. And the first Secretary of State I spoke to, not much happened. But the second, Matt Hancock, he'd only just started his job. And he asked me, you know, what one thing could we do to change, to help the NHS? And he'd read the book and was sort of having similar thoughts to you, I think, in terms of like surprise and anger and sadness. And I said, we need to do more to support the staff. And when I spoke to him, I was playing at the West End, as I do quite often, or did do when it was legal. And I said that in my dressing room there was a sign that says Theatre Helpline. If you've got any worries at all, if you're struggling about anything, phone this number 24/7, free phone. We'll point you in the right direction. And I said there's no such thing for doctors. There are there are some small organisations who are doing mm-hmm. wonderful things, but there's no like national. There's nothing that doctors can all access. Mm-hmm. And he was surprised to hear that. I mean, his feet were only just under the desk in his new job, and I couldn't expect him to know that already. He said, "Let me go and see and have a go away and have a look." And he came back and said, "Yeah, I mean, this is a big gap." And he. I'm not a spokesman for the Conservative Party by a long shout, but he did a great thing, and he chucked a big load of money towards a service so that all doctors, in the first instance, can access mental health support when they're struggling. And when he announced that this was originally just a service for London GPs. That was a great service, and it was expanded it hugely across the country. And when he announced this, he name-checked my book, right. And that is far and away the biggest thing that's happened, because my writing, the stuff I did that I hoped a few people would read, suddenly had a tangible effect that could help people who were in the position that I was a decade ago, and that's the thing that I'm most proud of as a result of this book.
Well, this is how I see you. You're such a catalyst for change, and I know. Are you an atheist? Is that right?
I'm culturally Jewish. My right. family are Jewish, but sort of only in it for the food. I don't have a God.
So for me, I have a faith, and when I look at your journey, and I've sort of seen the brilliant stuff you've done, so much for the Lullaby Trust, the charity. Your book to the NHS that I contributed to recently, you donated the profits to NHS and Lullaby Trust there. You've done so many different things for different people. And, talking about those old feelings of ill-placed guilt and I can't do this. If I'm not contributing the way I want to, then I have to leave. You've gone on to contribute in a way that is beyond anybody's wildest thoughts and dreams, and touched more. Leaving meant you could help more people and do all the things that you were unable to do there. And it's almost like this was your plan and this was your purpose, and you're giving more than ever, don't you think?
Oh, that's very kind of you to say. I've certainly got more time and more ability now to help people, and I'm very grateful to be in that position. I'm one of thousands and thousands and thousands of people who are doing exactly the same thing. I'm not the only person who's championing the mental health of medical professionals. But I just feel immensely grateful for the position I'm now in. Yeah.
You touched on going to meet the health secretaries. I know the book closes with a letter to Jeremy Hunt. Have you actually mm-hmm. met Jeremy Hunt then since?
I have, yes. I think it didn't go very well.
Spill the tea.
Okay.
We need to know.
The tea goes as follows. So this is very shortly after the book, This Is Going to Hurt, first came out. A letter came through to my publishers saying, the Secretary of State would be delighted to meet Adam. And I was like, is this a trap? Am I going to be lynched by some civil servants on the way, on the lift or something? And this was a man who I had so many things I wanted to say to, and mm-hmm. I'd been thinking about the impact of cuts to the health service budget and what that meant in, you know, in terms of the impact of the workers on the ground and ultimately the impact on the patients who they were trying to care for. And I think it had a devastating impact, these cuts. And so I literally spent a day writing down all of the thoughts in my head about the stuff I wanted to
You'd
talk
have
to them
take
about.
A list, wouldn't
and,
you?
And I brought my list.
He probably thought, oh, here he is with more diaries.
Yeah. and so, you know, sat down in his office and I was just like, question. He's an extremely clever man, mm-hmm. and he's extremely used to answering this sort of question. And it was like playing tennis against a pro. You know, however hard I tried as a terrible amateur tennis player, it was, you know, he didn't even need to think about it. He had the answer, but I kept going asking all my questions, and. He eventually said, "What is this? An interview? I thought I was inviting you in for some nice question, for a nice chat or something." And I was like, "Whatever." and then, you know, the odd chat sort of quickly wound up after that. And there was a, you know, no one likes leaving a room with this horrible, you know, tension in it.
That's not British. No, you can't do that.
So I apologised, obviously. I said, "I'm really sorry if I came across nicer in my book than I do in real life." And he said, "Oh, no, I think you've been quite consistent."
Fair play. Oh, yeah. My gosh. Well, I kind of admire him for the comeback. And then that was that.
But, you know, in fairness, during the pandemic, he has been a voice of sense and reason and pragmatism, mm-hmm. you know, in the House of Commons and in the Health Select Committee, asking the right questions. And, you know, and he's, in my eyes, he's not totally managed to redeem himself. But I've been very pleasantly surprised that he's been knowledgeable and, you know, as I say, asking all the right questions. So he isn't a pantomime villain, you know.
Yeah. So sometimes what people come to this podcast for is, you know, tips and advice and coping mechanisms. And, you know, you talked about how the diaries very much were sort of a way for you to relieve some of the burden and to reflect. Do you have any other coping mechanisms that worked for you? Because when, you know, on reading the books, and also Twas Night Before Christmas as well, another excellent book that went to number one. And, you know, you talk about your shifts and you talk about the ups and the downs. And sometimes really the downs outweighing the more joyous times. What else did you use? There were so many times in that book that were a reason for you to quit and you didn't. And what about people listening that are ready to give up on something? What did you rely on?
I mean, I would say I'm definitely the worst person to ask this question as someone who failed to cope. But since then, I have learnt and I've educated myself and I've helped educate other people about, you know, how to deal with this sort of situation.
You don't really class yourself as someone who failed to cope, do you?
I did fail to cope and I didn't. But part of that was not having the right equipment, not having the right, my own, you know, toolbox of things. And the diaries. So here's an example of how I got things wrong. So my parents knew that I'd left medicine. They didn't know why I'd left medicine until my book came out. My husband didn't know why I'd left the profession. They didn't know about this most pivotal, you know, moment of my life until a few months before that, when I first read out from my diaries up at the Edinburgh Festival. Mm. That isn't healthy, mm-hmm. but it's also not unusual. And I got and still get so many messages, emails and on Twitter and wherever from doctors, often very senior doctors, and mm-hmm. always start the same way. I've never told anyone this, but.
Yeah.
So there's this potentially quite British, but also I hear it from doctors around the world. This thing about medics, it says you're a bloody doctor and you bloody get on with it. Stiff upper lip, stiff drink, off you march. So, but there are ways to cope. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing magical about them. And the first thing is to take time out.
Yeah.
And that isn't necessarily possible in the NHS. And it should be, but people think it isn't. If your rotor's stretched so hard, you know, that no one can go home at 5 o'clock when they're meant to go home at 5 o'clock, it feels impossible to say to someone, maybe you need a week off there. But those weeks off, you know, will help with the retention of staff, because I'm not the only person who kept ploughing on after a bad incident before realising, you know, that I need to get out. And the second thing is to talk to people. Mm-hmm. And ideally someone who is a professional in talking. But not necessarily. Even if doctors and nurses and midwives and all the medical professionals are very bad at having a shoulder to cry on. You know, when you come home, how was your day? Yep, fine. Because yeah. It's easier to say, yeah, fine, than actually to open up and, you know, and risk the floodgates, you know, opening mm-hmm. too wide. But it's crucial to have someone who you can just be honest about your day at work. If it was just a minor irritation, or if it was if it's something you need to have a full-blown cry about, and that's really important. And you know, 1.5 million people work in the NHS. A lot of people who are listening to us chatting now will work for the NHS, but also the majority of people listening won't work for the NHS. But mm-hmm. every single one of those people will know someone who does. That the numbers just mean that, you know, everyone's got a friend or a neighbour or a relative mm-hmm. who works for the health service.
Well, it does lead me to wondering, how are you now? Because, you know, you talked about actually what happens as a result of being so transparent and sharing and being open is you then get everybody privately offloading onto you and opening up because they can't do it within their profession. And I have the same. And because of social media, you're quite accessible at any time. So sometimes, you know, I wake up at 6:30 in the morning and I have DMs, particularly at the moment, around domestic violence. They can be quite graphic photos of injuries, terrible stories from women who are trapped at home right now. And it can be quite overwhelming as being responsible and being, you know, I'm sure like me, you have charities you signpost people to and experts. But, you know, how do you deal with this new burden? Is that really horrible, that
one? No.
Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. I now take my own mental well-being much more seriously than I ever did before. I never thought about it before. And there are things that I do now but I don't keep anything bottled up.
Yeah.
And that's the crucial thing. And after this happened, my bad day at work, as I call it, I would wake up many nights of the week, you know, in a cold sweat, you know, bolt upright with my heart going 200 beats a minute, back in that operating theatre. Mm-hmm. And that happened for years. Since I've been talking about it, it wasn't the process of writing it down and getting it published, but it was more, you know, talking to people like you about it, or getting up on stage and reading out that diary entry. That has gone. And okay. I don't know if it probably isn't like PTSD in the truest sense of it. I don't even know if it would have been, because I think I was, I don't think I did very well in my psychiatry exams, but whatever I'm now doing by talking about it has exercised those demons. Mm. And I now take that approach with everything. And if I'm struggling with anything, I've got my group of people that I can speak to. And a lot of that time it's James, my poor husband, who has to deal with it. And sometimes he's not the right person to speak to. And I'm now closer, you know, to friends and indeed family. So I've got these people who I know can help me, and I know that I can help them if they're ever in the, you know, it's mutually beneficial to have that person. But it does take a toll. It really does. But it's a case of knowing that it's taking a toll.
Yeah, being
because
aware. Yeah.
I don't think I was aware of what it was doing to me when I was working in the profession. They teach you in GCSE physics, Newton or one of that lot, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. Mm-hmm. And it's never equal, but there's always an opposite reaction. You just have to be aware of that and make sure that you've got the mechanisms in place.
Well, one thing that has happened as a result of your books is you're adapting your book into a BBC comedy drama. And is it true that Ben Whishaw is playing you?
That is very true, yes. And
so did you have a say in that? Was that?
I did. I mean, it was absolutely bizarre because it's like this standard like dinner party conversation of who would play you in a thing of your life. And then suddenly we're sat in some, you know, basement of a production company, literally having that discussion with sort of A4 pages with lists of actors. But for me, it's always been Ben Whishaw. It could never have been anyone else. I think he's such an amazing actor. He's so versatile and so funny. I think he's a proper national treasure. And I was absolutely over the moon when he said yes. It was just, that's bizarre and brilliant. And fingers crossed, viruses permitting, we are shooting in January. We were meant to have been shooting already, but as you know, a lot of telly has bumped bumped back a bit. But hopefully in January, and I'm very excited.
So when will it be on telly? In another year's time, I guess,
to be honest, I don't really know. I guess it depends. I think it's now takes a bit longer to shoot things in COVID land, keeping everything and everyone safe and secure. But yeah, I imagine something like that. Don't quite know.
Oh, I can't wait. That's something to, we all need something to look forward to. And that is something to look forward to. So it's been so great to talk to you, and I'm so pleased that I've got your book here. This is going to be a present for my daughter. She's 7 in March, so
oh,
I thought,
perfect.
You know,
yeah,
I thought I'd let her have this. So before I let you go, I want to just finish the chat by reading one more review, because I love your Amazon reviews. They're so funny. So this is a review for Adam's new book, Kay's Anatomy. It says, I can remember without even looking that the hippocampus is the memory section of the brain. This is because of the brilliant illustration of the hippo going camping. I also like how the large intestine is also depicted as wearing a beret. Do you think that sums the book up pretty well?
I think it does. And it means I need to give huge, huge thanks to the wonderful illustrator, Henry Packer, who's just as big a part of the book as I am. And the drawings are, I'm just saying this dispassionately because I didn't do them, it was someone else. The drawings are so funny. And I know that's something a lot of kids have picked up on.
Yeah. Adam, you've been so extraordinary. You are one of my heroes, and I want to thank you for everything you've done for all of us and continue to do now.
Thank you so much, Kate. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. If you haven't already, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this, please help us spread the word. Rate and review the show where you got this, or share on socials.